Now, if you think for a moment, I'm going to take you to a place that we haven't been for probably 6 months or more. That is the book of Daniel. Think about Daniel 2 for a moment. That's that statue of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Head of gold, arms of silver, belly of bronze, legs of iron. We've actually worked our way down through the statue as we've been going through this. Of course, the head of gold was which kingdom? Babylon. And that was before we started. That was back during Scott's class, Ezra and Nehemiah. You're still back in Babylon. We picked up at the end of the Babylonian Empire. And what's the next empire? Medo-Persia. And that was also in Scott's class, right? Ezra and Nehemiah. You're still in the period of the Persian kings. And actually, I guess we began with moving quickly past the Medo-Persians and into the belly of bronze, which was which empire? Greek. We spent a lot of time on the Greek Empire. Started with Alexander. We've moved through the division of his kingdom. We've gone on and spent a lot of time with the war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucid Empire. And focused mainly on what was happening in Israel rather than what was happening with those empires. Last week, I kind of introduced the final empire, the legs of iron, which was which empire? Rome. Yeah, we introduced Rome. I just mentioned a few of the key figures and a little bit of what was happening. And we're going to back up. If you didn't catch that last week, we're going to back up and we're going to go through it again a little bit slower this time. I wanted to introduce them last week because we were talking about the high priest, and I was trying to figure out a way to explain how we got all these different high priests in office, and you couldn't really talk about the office holder without talking about the Romans, who were the ones controlling who got the office and why the Romans controlled them. And so we talked a little bit about Rome's religious situation, if we can use that term kind of loosely, for religion. But now we're going to talk more about their politics this evening. And in Rome, there really was two different bodies that really embodied the power of Rome. One of them should come to mind. Who had the power in Rome? Okay, the emperor. And for the New Testament period, that's true. And we'll talk about the emperor. The emperor would be the Caesars. Of course, they didn't really start until Augustus, and we'll talk about Augustus and when he took power and became emperor. And what was the other sort of political body for? The Senate. Yeah, we still got a Senate. So there was actually another political body, the plebeians, who had a sort of like our lower house, but they didn't have nearly as much power as our lower house. But the Senate was the ones who made the laws. And by the time the emperors come along, the emperors had the right to sort of veto. And that's where we get our veto. The emperor had an absolute veto. He could veto anything he wanted to if he didn't like the law. So he was the law. Senate would just really advise and consent rather than actually try to override anything the emperor wanted. But before this, in the time period sort of corresponding to the Greek Empire, the Romans were a republic, and the Senate had all the power. And the power was mostly in the hands of the two men who led the Senate. We talked about that office in an earlier lesson. Anyone remember it? It was the consuls. There was a senior consul and a junior consul, and the two consuls really led the Senate and therefore had most of the power. And whenever there was a crisis in the empire, which happened usually during war, the Senate would vote to either choose one of the consuls or in some cases a different man altogether and make him dictator of Rome. Don't read about that very much in the history books. It actually happened several times in Roman history. They'd pick a man and say he was dictator of Rome. He had 1 year. He could do anything he wanted. The Senate would stamp it. And that 1 year, he had to step down, which is kind of an interesting way to run a dictatorship. But about the time that Julius Caesar, Pompey the Great, and Crassus decided to form a government. It was against actually a man who had been dictator for 3 years running, and they decided they wanted, that wasn't good. You were supposed to be 1 year and out. So they formed their triumvirate, and really that sort of changed the whole method of Roman government. Eventually, first you had two groups of three, and then they all broke up, and eventually you end up with just one man as emperor. Well, as they started to conquer, they take over new territory, and Rome kept expanding. And they had to have different ways, and we'll talk about why it's important from the New Testament perspective, but they had to have different ways to govern all this new territory. They come in three types. Right? In your New Testaments, when we read it, usually most modern translations just say the governor. Roman had a lot more than just calling somebody a governor. A governor is what you did. You governed. But they actually had titles that indicated what kind of government you were running, and we'll explain that this evening. The first was a client kingdom. That is, a kingdom that became part of the Roman Empire, not an ally. They would have friends and allies, too. You could be an allied kingdom. If you're allied, you're completely independent. If you are a client kingdom, it'd be the old way of paying tribute. You're subject to Rome, to Rome's laws. But you were allowed to keep your king. And if you didn't have one, one would be appointed for you. They were willing, they would pick out a king if there wasn't one. If you were going to be a client kingdom, they were semi-autonomous within their own borders. They could pretty much do what the king wanted. They had, we talked about the right of the sword last week. That is, they could have troops. They could have capital punishment within their borders. One of the interesting things about the right of the sword is it never included Roman citizens. Right? You had the right to punish people in your own borders, but you did not have the right to punish Roman citizens. And who famously used that? Paul. Right? Paul said, I appeal to Caesar. Right? You don't have the right to punish me. And that was even to a Roman governor. Roman governor didn't have the right to punish he had the right of the sword, but he didn't have the right to punish a Roman citizen. You always had that out to be able to appeal to Caesar. They also had to bring troops. If you're a client kingdom, if Rome went to war, you had to supply people to help fight the war. But most provinces, most things didn't become client kingdoms. Rome only picked out a few for various reasons that they allowed to be a client kingdom. Rome much preferred them to be a province. And they came in two different kinds of provinces. There were the imperial provinces, and we'll talk about these a little bit more in just a moment as we flip the slides. But an imperial province was one that was controlled almost directly by the emperor. We're going to sort of focus on the imperial side of these things rather than what happened earlier. The emperor chose who was going to be the governor. The emperor chose governors who would lead troops. These provinces usually were on the fringes of the empire. They're the ones that had legions stationed there. They're the ones that were the most difficult, the ones that had a history of rebellion. Those are the ones the emperor kept as imperial provinces. Why would you think the emperor would want the ones that seemed the most difficult? Let's make you see if you can think about it from the Roman perspective. So he could keep his eye on the troublemakers, the rebellious people. That's part of it. And if there were troublemakers there, what else was there? Troops. And he wanted to keep his eye on the troops, right? Because as Roman history showed over and over again, it's usually the troops who made the emperor. And he didn't want anyone to have their hands on governing the troops without his hands being on them. Other provinces he gave to the Senate. Oh, well, one more thing the emperor sort of wanted. He always got the new provinces as they were moving out. Those were also usually the rich provinces because they hadn't been exploited yet. All right, the older provinces were rich in that they had a lot of trade going on, but you know they didn't have a lot of necessarily, you know, easy plunder. Right, they've already been plundered over and over and over again. But the emperor was taking those new provinces where he could garner a lot of wealth for himself. The Senate got the rest of the provinces. And the Senate had various rules, and we'll talk about those briefly this evening. Generally, the Senate provinces didn't have many troops. They might have some auxiliary troops for keeping the peace, but not the Roman legions, the equivalent of our army or something. Okay, an imperial province. They also come in different sizes. The major provinces, those were the really large pieces like Syria. They were commanded by a legate. The legate, his name should remind you, is the commander of a legion, at least one. They might have multiple legions, but if there was a legion, then there was a legate who was in charge of the legion. He was the governor of the province, but he was also the commanding general. Actually, he was over the commanding general of the legion, or of each legion. He also had the right of the sword. He was the one who carried that right, the right to punish, capital punishment, the right to lead the troops. Interestingly, the legate was always a senator. You can see how they kind of tried to do their own checks and balances like we do in our government. A senator was always chosen to be the legate, either a proconsul, one who had once been consul, therefore had shown his skills as a politician, or he was what they called a pro praetor, which means that he went up either through a military, that is, he had been a general, or he had been a magistrate, but not a consul. He went up through one of the other avenues of the Romans had for, you know, attaining high office. He could be either of those. He could be appointed a legate. The one thing the legate didn't have was control of the money. That's what a procurator was. A procurator was the money man for the province, for a large imperial province. Why would you want the money in somebody's hands who wasn't the man in charge of the troops? Huh?
That kind of checks and
balances. Right, because the emperor was a former senator and thinks, if I give a senator troops and money, he might be the next emperor. So I'll give him troops, because we don't want the troops in the hands of somebody who doesn't know how to run the troops, but we're not going to give him any money. We're going to put the money in the hand of the procurator, and the procurator has to pay the troops. And he leads, this guy over here pays. And all the money that comes in goes to the procurator. He's the head of, you know, the IRS for them. All the money coming in, all the mines, all the gold and everything gets mined, goes through the procurator's office. He's in charge of all the resources. The other guy's just in charge of judging and leading troops. Kind of split it up. The procurator was never a senator. Don't want buddies getting together and deciding like Caesar and Crassus and Pompey to take over the empire. So the procurator was never a senator. Rather, he was, as I put up there, usually an equestrian, which was a rank below. There were senatorial families, those who made up the Senate, and then there were equestrians, the Roman knights. Not knights like medieval times, but the Roman knights who were a second tier, usually made up the military generals or lower ranks in the military, officer corps. Or it could be an imperial freedman. What's a freedman? Not a term we use much anymore. Okay, could be somebody who bought the citizenship and was freed. They came in free. They had to buy it from the emperor to be an imperial freedman. That was one way to get it. One way was probably the one that came to your minds first, but nobody wanted to say it. You could be a former slave of the emperor, and the emperor could choose to free you, which he often did. If he trusted this man, he could choose to free him. And usually, again, slavery wasn't held in the complete derogatory way that we hold it today. It was considered a legitimate way for a poor man to become powerful. I mean, you could be the emperor's slave, he could free you, and you could become procurator of a province. You know, think about it. You could go from being a nobody to being the second most powerful man in a province. That's kind of a, you know, it was another avenue of advancement for some. And the third way is by doing something, it's almost like paying for it, bribing for it, doing something really important and impressive to the emperor, that the emperor decides to give you citizenship. And if you're a non-citizen, you become an imperial freedman. What all of those things have in common is the emperor. Right? You owe your citizenship to the emperor, therefore the emperor is your friend. He's got a friend who's in charge of the money. At least that was the idea behind it. Minor provinces, and there were some, there were a few provinces on the outskirts that didn't rate having a legion posted in it, but the emperor didn't want to give it over to a senator for some reason. And then he would put a prefect in charge, usually. A prefect, again, was usually of the equestrian rank, could also be a freedman as well. A prefect had auxiliary troops and a limited right of the sword. That is, he wasn't allowed to take his troops outside his territory. He had a lot more restrictions placed on who he could judge and when he could judge. There are a lot more controls over him. Anyone know the most famous prefect? We'll talk about him again in a few minutes. But who's the most famous prefect in the New Testament? Because all your Bibles say governor, don't they? Pontius Pilate, yeah, he was prefect. This is Jerusalem, Judea, at the time of Pontius Pilate. No troops were stationed at that time in Judea. And it was a troublemaking place, so there was a Roman prefect, and we'll talk about why in a lesson probably next week or the week after. Sometimes there would be a procurator with the prefect. And there are a few times where there was just a procurator and no prefect at all. Kind of interesting. Basically, if the emperor thought, things were going to go pretty smoothly, he just put the money man in charge, didn't give them any troops, didn't give them any right of the sword usually, and would just let the procurator pay the taxes and if something comes up, some police action is needed, the procurator can handle it. And again, if there's a prefect without a procurator, then he handles both offices. And so it could be one or the other. The exception was always Egypt, where there was an equestrian knight who always had legions. There was no legate. And there were always more than one legion in Egypt, because Egypt was the source of all kinds of trouble for the empire, and the emperor never trusted any senator to command all the troops that he usually had to station in Egypt. So he didn't want to make it a major province with a legate in charge, just in case. So you can sort of see how the politics went there. Okay, what does that mean for us? Well, we'll get to it. I forgot. I got the senatorial provinces. We got the other side of the coin. Usually the more peaceful provinces, further away from the border, usually governed either by a proconsul or a propraetor, just like the legate was. But these were chosen by the Senate, by the Senate rules. I just thought it was interesting. Two of the Senate rules were, if you had a large family and you wanted a governorship, you could get one, because they thought it paid well. So the larger your family was, you could move up the, and say, hey, I want this, and they would give you one. Or if you recently got married and you wanted to, I guess, have a honeymoon, I'm sure. It was one of their rules, though. If you recently got married and you wanted a governorship, they would give you one. It also explains why several of them got married multiple times, because every time they got married, they got a new governorship, taking advantage of the rules. They were sometimes, actually often, granted the title of proconsul when they took their governorship, whether or not they were actually a proconsul or not. You might think that doesn't make any difference. It made a difference to them. It had to do with how much power they had, how much authority they had, especially with dealing with each other and with one another. I mean, they're all in charge of who's in charge of the pecking order. All right? A proconsul had six, what they called lictors, six men who carried rods that showed how much power he had. If you were only a prefect, you only had five. If you come into a meeting and this guy's got six and you've got five, then you're obviously below him and he takes charge. And since all the major provinces by the emperor had six lictors, the Senate usually awarded them six lictors and called them a proconsul even if they actually didn't merit it. One of those interesting things. Again, they also had a limited right of the sword. They could judge. They could take care of internal conflicts. They weren't allowed to start any wars. That's why they were away from the borders. They couldn't have a war with each other either. There are some New Testament examples of this. That's why I said we'll get to some things that actually apply to your New Testament reading. Achaia, which is around Corinth, Cyprus, Asia Minor, Crete, Macedonia, those are all examples of senatorial provinces. A couple of those who are mentioned in the New Testament, somebody turn there to Acts chapter 13 and read for us 6 through 12. Okay, we have a proconsul, Sergius Paulus. It's interesting, in the 1800s, it was common for critics of the Bible to say, oh, here's an example of where Luke got it wrong. He calls him proconsul. He was on the island of Cyprus. It was a senatorial province. He couldn't have been proconsul. Archaeologists, including William Ramsey, who was one of those in the late 1800s, who did a lot of digging on Cyprus as well as other places, discovered tablets that actually named four different senatorial governors who were awarded the title proconsul. So he wasn't the only one. And Luke was right. There is a stone that has consul, proconsul, Sergius Paulus on it. He had to back away from it and say, well, Luke was right about that title. William Ramsey actually wrote a book on the life journeys of Paul, because He thought Luke had gotten all the names and titles wrong, and after he did archaeology for like 20 years, he said Luke was the most accurate historian he ever knew. That all the names and titles were exactly right, and archaeology could find almost every single one of them. But Sergius Paulus, his full name Lucius Sergius Paulus, we know he was proconsul because of the archaeology digs on Cyprus. We also know he became a curator of the Tiber. That may not sound that impressive. Curator, we think of people in museums, right? All right, but think about procurator. Procurator was the money man, right? The curator, would anyone know what the Tiber is? It's a river. What river is it? Or where is it? It's the river in Rome. Curator of the Tiber is the men who collect all the money of things that happen along the banks of the Tiber River. That's trade, ships coming and going, that's businesses. There were six men. There was so much trade and everything that happened on the Tiber. Six different men were appointed at the same time to handle all the money. It was considered to be an extremely important position. And we know that Claudius appointed him as curator of the Tiber in AD 47 because there's an actual stone in Rome that has the inscription, Proconsul Sergius Paulus, appointed curator of the Tiber, along with a list of other people who were also appointed to that position. Usually a governor, a senatorial governor, governed for 3 years, so we can sort of date when Paul must have been there. We know it was before 47, so we know Acts 13 happened before 47, probably 44, 45, 46, somewhere in that time frame. We're not exactly sure. It could have been a few years earlier. We don't have any documentation as to when he began, but we know he was certainly over and done by AD 47. Some have pointed out that if, since Luke says he believed, assuming he became a Christian, he's not mentioned in Paul's letter to the Romans much later. So perhaps he was no longer in Rome, or perhaps he had died. The last inscription to mention him was that boundary stone when he was appointed curator, so we don't know what happened to him after that. The other one is in Acts 18. Somebody read for us 12 to 17. Okay. Gallio, if you love him or hate him from what he does in the New Testament, just a little bit about him. Again, he's got a much longer name, Lucius Junius Gallio Ananias. He was the brother of Seneca, if you're a fan of Roman writing, famous writer Seneca. Their father was also named Seneca, not quite as famous, but his brother was very famous. His brother was actually the tutor of Nero. I don't know if that's, you know, something you want to put on your resume or not. But he was against his will. He was told he was going to be the tutor of Nero, whether he liked it or not, because he was such a famous writer, even in his own time. He was made proconsul of Achaia, the old-fashioned way. He actually was consul. Became proconsul AD 51. In AD 52, he resigned. He said his health was poor. He didn't do the full 3 years, which really helps us. Everybody always points to this and says, we know exactly, within 6 months, give or take, when this event happened. Because he was only there, basically, 1 year. from point in 51 to a point in 52. So, you know, Acts 18, we know pretty much had to happen AD 51 or AD 52. He went back to Rome. He lived quite a bit longer after he went back to Rome. His brother died, and then Nero, a few years later, thought, based on a rumor, that Gallio had been complicit in a conspiracy to kill Nero, so he ordered Gallio to prove his innocence by killing himself. And he did. So, I guess he was innocent. He did take the poison and committed suicide. That was AD 65. He was 64 when he killed himself. So there's a few things that perhaps you can sort of clue some of these names and titles as to, you know, when you're reading the New Testament, you see things, you can actually learn something about who these people were. Now getting to Judea, because that's what we're actually interested in. Judea goes through a number of different stages in its relationship to Rome. We talked a little bit about this period last week, 63 BC down to 48 BC. It was a major province. I'm still calling it an imperial province, even though there wasn't technically an emperor yet. John Hyrcanus, we talked about last week, the second, was the ethnarch, as well as the high priest. The legate of Syria was the governor with the right of the sword. And remember, Antipater, who was the father of what New Testament character? Herod the Great. Antipater was made formerly a governor of Judea, was now the chief Judean judge and the chief publican. What's a publican? Tax collector. For those who don't know, let me briefly explain Roman taxes. Works a little bit differently. The idea of a publican is that Rome wanted their taxes, wanted to make sure they got them and got them now. And therefore, they would offer their provinces. If you wanted to be the chief publican of a province, Rome would say, basically, highest bidder. You paid for the office. That is, you paid the taxes in advance for your whole province. So if you paid for Pennsylvania and you said, okay, I'm paying $100 million for the right to collect taxes, you've paid the $100 million in cash up front. See, you can see how the Roman government liked that. They got their money. It's all up front. They know how much they're getting. Now they can budget. Now it's up to you to collect your money. And the way the Roman chief publicans worked was they farmed it out the same way. Okay, we got 100 counties. Everybody, $1 million each or more, maybe $2 million each. I want to make a profit, right? Everybody who wants to be a publican over your county pays the chief publican. He had the right to farm it out. And then the chief publican of each county would farm it out to little districts, right? And then the guy at the very end, the common publican, he was the one who had to be out there on the street collecting taxes. And therefore, John the Baptist says, if you're a publican, don't collect more than what's due. Because, of course, you know, you'd collect what's due, and then you'd say, hey, I want a little bit more because I got to get some profit out of this. So that was the Roman system of sort of an inverted system of taxes. And Antipater, remember, he was the wealthy Idumean, married to a noble woman from Arabia, had a lot of money. He paid both to be chief judge and to be the chief publican, and it was a money-making scheme for Antipater at this point. That was under Pompey the Great. Then it became basically a minor province from 48 BC to 53 BC. John Hyrcanus, still the ethnarch and high priest. Antipater was now promoted to being a procurator, making him in charge of the finances. In order to be a procurator, what else happened to Antipater? Don't necessarily mention up there. I think I have it on a different screen. But. Procurator had to be an imperial freedman. He used some of that money he was collecting to bribe At this point, it was probably Mark Antony. Pay a large enough fund, got to be a Roman citizen, got to be made the procurator. He did the finances now, so a little bit better position even than being the publican. And he got lucky that Mark Antony and Pompey were all busy with a sort of a civil war going on among themselves, and they didn't even bother to appoint a prefect, and so he was in charge of the troops as well. He sort of got everything. And so he appointed two of his sons, his oldest two sons, Phasael, his oldest, and Herod, later called Herod the Great. Phasael got Jerusalem and Judea as his province, and Herod got Galilee and Samaria as his province underneath their father. Right? Their father was the procurator. They were the governors of each of these smaller pieces of that land. The brothers, pretty much hated by the countrymen because their father was an Idumean, their mother was an Arab, and they were really more Roman than they were Hebrew in any sense of the word. They had no Hebrew blood at all. They weren't well liked. In 43 BC, Antipater was poisoned, possibly due to the Roman conflicts, possibly due to internal conflicts. You can pick up a book and you'll find all kinds of people who have all kinds of theories about who killed Antipater and why. But it was right about the same time that Julius Caesar, just within a year of Julius Caesar's murder. So, you know, Caesar was most likely part of the people who supported Antipater. Remember, because Antipater helped him out when he was in a hard situation with the troops down in Egypt. So he dies shortly after Caesar dies. And now it switches back to being a major imperial province. John Hyrcanus continues as the high priest for the next 3 years. Phasael gets appointed as a tetrarch over Jerusalem and Judah. Herod becomes a tetrarch over Galilee and Samaria. And the legate of Syria has the right of the sword and has the troops. Basically, they were worried about the civil war. This is when Brutus and Crassus are fighting Mark Antony and Augustus. There's a civil war going on, so they sort of stick Judea with Syria, put the control in the legate, but they promote the two brothers. They get a higher position, tetrarch, a ruler of a fourth of the kingdom, because they didn't give them all of the kingdom, didn't even give them half each. They each got the part they were governor of before. And in the middle of the civil war, this is where you might want to go back to your Maccabean chart there. Over on the left-hand side, Mattathias Antigonus. Antigonus led a rebellion. Antigonus was the nephew of Hyrcanus, the high priest. And when his father, Aristobulus, was taken captive by Pompey back to Rome, Antigonus fled. Actually, he first was taken to Rome with his father, and then he escaped and fled to Parthia. What was Parthia? What do we think of it today? Yeah, or what other kingdom was Parthia? We know it by two other names. Before this, we knew it as Persia. Today, we know it as Iran, right? He flees to Parthia, which is now what Persia was called, asking for their protection, at least at first. His father, he tries several times to launch his own little rebellion back in Judea to reclaim the throne his father had lost. It never worked for him. His father eventually gets murdered while in Rome. Finally, in 41 BC, Antigonus convinces Parthia this is the perfect time to invade. The Romans are all distracted. Brutus and Crassus are fighting Mark Antony and Augustus. They're all up there in Greece and Thessaly. They're having this big war. Let's take Syria. And it actually works. This time the Parthians listen to him and they invade in force. And when they invade, they come into Syria, what used to be the Seleucid Empire. And the legate of Syria sees this big army coming and he says, "Hey, let me join. I'll just turn my troops over to you and we'll just join forces." Possibly helped because a former general of Brutus's is now the commander of the Parthian forces. So now you got two Roman generals leading Parthian forces as well as Roman legions, conquering what used to be the Seleucid Empire. The John Hyrcanus, remember, the high priest, and Phasael, tetrarch of Judea, received word, as well as Herod, they all received word that the Parthians wished them to surrender. And they decide to go and surrender, Phasael and John Hyrcanus. Herod says he doesn't believe it, he's not going. Hyrcanus and Phasael go to surrender. Antigonus captures them. Remember, Antigonus is the nephew of Hyrcanus. And he cuts off both the ears of John Hyrcanus II in order to make him unfit to be high priest any longer. He doesn't want him coming back later, but he didn't want to kill him because it's his uncle. Family, yeah. Cuts off both of his ears, lets him go free. And he kills Phasael, because he's not related at all to Phasael. So he just kills him, get rid of the tetrarch of Judah. Herod, in the meantime, takes off. And Antigonus is appointed the king and high priest, just like he always wanted to be. And he's the last of the Hasmoneans, right? The Maccabean family. He's the last one to hold both titles. And he managed to hold on to it for all of 3 years. Herod, as I said, fled to Rome. Got to Rome. He explained what was happening back in Judea to Rome. And he says, to his surprise, the Roman Senate convened and appointed him king of Judea. You know, he was the tetrarch, and suddenly now he's king of Judea. And they order him, because they're still busy with their civil war, they order him to return home and put his kingdom to rest. You know, pacify it. And they granted him 2 legions and generals to command the legions. They wouldn't let him command the legions because he was only an imperial freedman, because he's got his position from his father. But they said, you know, "You're the king. Here's some troops, here's some generals, go take care of business at home while we continue our civil war." And so he does. Mark Antony is currently in Egypt when Herod arrives. Mark Antony helps out. Herod, as he takes both Galilee and Samaria first, then he takes Jerusalem and Judah. In return, Herod then sends troops with Antony as Antony heads north to fight the Parthians. He's the one who gets sent to push back the Parthians. Antigonus is turned over to Mark Antony because Herod doesn't want to be blamed for his death, because some people did like him. He was the last Hasmonean king and high priest. Herod didn't want his blood on Herod's hands. So Herod gives him over to Mark Antony and says, "Make sure he doesn't come back." Mark Antony takes him with him up to Antioch, where he has him both scourged and then crucified. And, of course, then he's not coming back. So from 37 BC forward, Judea now becomes a client kingdom, because the Roman Senate had voted Herod to be king. So now it's a kingdom. They pay tribute to Rome through the Syrian procurator, right? The Syrian legate has the troops, the procurator gets the money. He had a right of the sword, except he was not granted permission to fight externally. The Syrian legate and procurator had to take the census of the people to know what the tribute was going to be owed. And where does that come up in the New Testament? Birth of Jesus, right? It was time for another census. That was part of the legate and procurator. In fact, Luke specifically names the legate as the one who commanded that there be a census. That's so that they could figure out how much they owed that. I can't remember how often they did their census, but you know, it's a recounting so that we make sure we get the right amount of tribute from the client kingdom. In 37 BC, Herod divorced his wife of that time, disinherited his son Antipater, named after his father, and he exiled them in order to marry Mariamne, who is the granddaughter of John Hyrcanus. Why would he want to do that? You can see it there on your little chart. Raises popularity. Hasmoneans were very popular. Also does what? Connects him to the priesthood. He never used it himself, but he's now at least connected to the priesthood. He's also connected to... I mean, he is king, but he's an Idumean. He's an Arabian. He's now connected to a Judean family, right? And a popular Judean family. He's the son-in-law, he can claim. You know, I'm a descendant, sort of, you know, in-law at least, of kings. So he's married to Mariamne. And you can see there of how complicated the relationship was, because Mariamne was also the grand, or would be the niece of Antigonus, the guy that just got crucified. So he crucifies him, and then a few years later marries his niece. That's politics. Okay, so we'll talk about Herod next week. We're going to talk about Herod the Great and Herod the Madman. Because he did both things. He was both a great ruler, and he was really crazy in a lot of other ways. So we'll do that next week.